Welcome back to the program. We live in an age of extremism. Our politics sustained by the polarization of left and right, even our entertainment, leisure, and shopping is often shaped by the red state and blue state divide. Underlying all of this is not just our politics, but the culture wars that revolve around fundamental religious belief. In fact, nothing has become more extreme and more polarized than religion itself. But is there an alternative as we seek middle ground in our politics, driven by goodwill and good intentions? Can we in fact find a middle ground between the extreme views of fundamentalism and atheism? Famed prosecutor Vince Bugliosi thinks so. In fact, he thinks that agnosticism is not only the middle ground, but that it is the real position of morality and faith. With the same verve with which he took on Charles Manson, examined the Kennedy assassination, and successfully prosecuted 105 jury trials in the L.A. District Attorney's Office, he now takes on the religious extremes who, as in the past, threaten to take down civilization itself. It is my pleasure to welcome Vince Bugliosi back on this program to talk about his new book, Divinity of Doubt, The God Question. Vince Bugliosi, thanks so much for joining us again.
Happy to be on the show again, Jeff.
Great to have you here. First of all, what got you interested in taking on religion and the extremism of religion as your next subject?
Well, I tend to take on pretty big challenges, as you know, Jeff. I took on the U.S. Supreme Court for Bush v. Gore, the betrayal of America. I've taken on George Bush, you know, the prosecution of Bush for murder, for taking the nation to war under false pretenses. And in fact, that's about to become a documentary for the big screen. We're 98% complete on it. I've always been fascinated by the whole issue of God, as most people have been, and I had read the Bible and done much thinking about it throughout the years, wrote a lot of notes to myself, but I decided to take 2 years out of my life and completely immerse myself in the subject 7 days a week, which is what I normally do when I'm working on something, to see if these age-old religious beliefs had any merit to them. And at the expense of sounding presumptuous, what I discovered, Jeff, is so startling. I know it sounds hard to believe, but it's absolutely startling. What I discovered is so startling that if someone reading Divinity of Doubt is not stunned by what they read, then they're the type of people that probably would not be surprised if they saw a man jump away from his own shadow. If we have a moment, I'd like to just summarize just a couple of them. There's many, many more. I found that, contrary to popular belief, the Bible does not really support the notion of free will. In fact, astonishingly, the Bible supports the exact opposite, that there is no free will, and I have many citations in my book for that. It turns out that the immortality of the soul was a pure invention of Plato. And Christianity was forced to embrace it. Why? Because without the immortality of the soul, there's no life after death. And if there's no life after death, then there's no heaven and hell for Christianity to offer or threaten its followers with. Perhaps the most startling revelation, and there's many more, if you read the New Testament in conjunction with the Hebrew Bible, the evidence is clear. It proves, not just beyond a reasonable doubt, but beyond all doubt, that according to the Bible, Jesus, in fact, was not born of a virgin, which by definition means he's not the Son of God. If he's not the Son of God, then the Christian doctrine that God had his Son die on the cross for our sins goes out the window too, in effect ravaging much of Christianity. And I know it's hard to believe, and we can get into the support for what I'm saying later if we have time, but it just happens to be true. The consensus of people that have read Divinity of Doubt, its publication date was just yesterday, but there's been early copies that have gone out. The consensus seems to be that no one who reads this book is ever again going to feel quite the same way about God and religion, and that is the precise reason why anyone who is deeply religious and has no doubt about God and Jesus and gets much comfort from much comfort and strength and solace from their religious beliefs, I definitely recommend that they do not read this book. Now, I'm sure some people listening saying, well, he's just using reverse psychology to get people to read the book. If they feel that way, there's nothing I can do about it. I'm just telling you, and I'm very sincere about it, that if you're deeply religious, this is not a book for you to read. This book is for the majority of Christians who believe in God, but have doubts, and of course for agnostics and also atheists. But this has been a 2,000-year-old conversation, Jeff, and I don't know if you're aware that it is a fact that nothing significant has been brought to the table for a great many years. And believe it or not, this book, Divinity of Doubt, does do that. There's a lot of very, very, very heavy things in here. We're not talking about silly stuff like the Da Vinci Code, where he has Jesus marrying Mary Magdalene and having children. And you know what the number one book in the country right now is, Jeff? A three-year-old boy has an appendectomy operation. It's in nonfiction.
Right.
And during his operation, he sees Jesus, he sees John the Baptist, his oldest sister, stuff like that. There's a book on Noah's Ark, sex and desire in the Bible. When you go to heaven, is it your body or your soul? This is very, very light fare. But what we're talking about here is very heavy, that if recognized as being true, literally shakes the very foundations of Christianity.
If, in fact, those things are true, why do you come to agnosticism instead of atheism?
Well, I view atheism basically as being a very empty philosophy. Their chief champions now at the moment, I'm talking about Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins. These people simply cannot find a non sequitur that they don't like. They have yet to come up with one strong, in my opinion, persuasive argument for the non-existence of God. There may not be a God. There's no way for us to know that. But my view is that atheistic dogma does not lead us rationally to the conclusion that there's no God. I'll just give you a couple non sequiturs of theirs. They say, well, if there's a God, how can there be all the horror and suffering and misery in the world? But that presupposes that God has to be all good. Where do they come up with that? Just because he's all-powerful, if you believe he's all-powerful, doesn't mean that he has to be all good. It's a complete non sequitur. They have the view that man evolved from some original life form. I find it a little difficult to conceptualize bacteria evolving into a Mozart or any other human. But they say, and they believe very strongly, and maybe they're right, that we all started from a bacteria. However, that doesn't eliminate God. That presupposes that God could not have created the original life form, and then evolution took over from there. Perhaps one of their very biggest non sequiturs, and Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens particularly embrace these two very, very explicitly. They think that if they can eliminate religion, which is an unworthy opponent, they've also eliminated God. But that's a non sequitur, because who says that to have a God, you also have to have organized religion? The opposite of God is no God, not no religion. There's millions of people out there who are not members of any organized religion at all, but polls show they still believe very, very strongly in God. So I do take on atheism in the book, but the main target of the book, of course, is theism.
Right.
And then I get into other major religions too. But the main target is theism, and the fundamental weakness of theism, as we all know, is that the belief in God is based on faith, and faith, by definition, is a belief in the unknown, belief in that for which there is no proof, and the question presents itself, why should we believe so strongly in something for which there is no proof? And they don't seem to have an answer for that. The other problem of atheism, of course, is that the pillars upon which atheism is predicated simply do not stand up to scrutiny. I'm talking about things that I've just mentioned, like free will, the virgin birth, the immortality of the soul. If you're an atheist, you don't believe in God. If you're a theist, you do. An agnostic says, I don't know. Actually, the better definition of an agnostic is that he believes it's unknowable. If it's unknowable, of course, you can't believe. I do have to say that I have a rather bright fellow, Jeff, on my side. You know who that fellow is? Einstein.
Right.
Einstein was an agnostic. Interestingly enough, Darwin was also an agnostic. I say interestingly enough because most evolutionists are atheists, and yet the founder of evolution, Darwin, said near the time of his death that he was an agnostic. In fact, at the time he wrote his classic in 1859, The Origin of the Species, he said, I was a theist. So there's a great amount of mystery out there. I feel that whether or not there's a God is an impenetrable a mystery. I believe it's beyond human comprehension. Einstein himself said that the problem is too vast for our limited minds, and in recognition, recognizing the limits of what we know, I really think that the most sensible and responsible position to take on the eternal question of God's existence is agnosticism. I love Gertrude Stein's quote. You've probably heard it. She said, there ain't no answer. There ain't going to be any answer. There never has been an answer. That's the answer. So I've come to agnosticism because I think that's the only sound position to take. How in the world do we know whether or not there's a God? It's just an absolute mystery.
Talk a little bit about what you write about with respect to morality and how the concept of morality fits into this notion of agnosticism.
Well, Thomas Huxley, he's the fellow that came up with the term, I think in 1869, agnosticism, although he said that the first agnostic was probably Socrates. I'm not convinced that morality fits into agnosticism, but I do mention, in quoting Huxley, he said, listen, why should we believe in things about which there is no knowledge? And if we want to be honest human beings and not believe in things for which we have no knowledge, maybe the first step we should take is to realize that the only intelligent approach to take is agnosticism. If we lie to ourselves, that's the first lie, then lying to others becomes so much easier. And we're lying to ourselves when we believe strongly that there is or is not a God.
In the work that you did as a criminal prosecutor, you certainly saw an awful lot of good and evil in the world.
Right.
To what extent did that influence and have an impact on your views?
I'm not sure it had any influence on the issue of agnosticism. I don't. It may have. There may have been a subliminal inference, but I saw an enormous amount of evil out in the world, and not just in the people I prosecuted and sent to death row. I actually believe in the secular counterpart of original sin, that most people, not all. But most people, if given a chance, they are disposed to avarice and being no good. And I give several examples about that. In fact, if we believe the Bible, Ephesians says that we're all born with an evil nature. But I'm not sure there's any nexus between the evil that I saw and this notion of agnosticism. I'm probably an agnostic because my whole orientation is evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's no evidence there, then why are we sounding off that there is or is not a God? And I think I have a fairly good grasp on how to assess evidence. I think I have a fair amount of credibility in that area. Just last month, at the invitation of the Pentagon, I gave a 3-hour lecture to a conference of Marine prosecutors down at Camp Pendleton. And I can tell you, and we can get into the support for it if we have time, that there's proof beyond all doubt that under the Bible, Jesus was not born of a virgin. And the question is, I'm not suggesting that the church is closed, of course, but how do you keep the doors open, Jeff, on literally hundreds of thousands of Christian churches around the world, if it turns out that Jesus, according to the Bible, was not the Son of God? You have to realize these churches are shrines to Jesus, not the incredibly monstrous God of the Old Testament. By its very name, Christianity is 95% Jesus. And how do you keep these doors open? And they're going to remain open. Don't question that. But how do you really keep them open if the Bible itself, which Christianity says supports the virgin birth, in fact does not support the virgin birth? How do you keep these doors open?
Why do you think we see such an increase in fundamentalism and extremism in religion today?
There very definitely is an increase in religiosity and fundamentalism in America, fundamentalism. But you're aware, Jeff, that this is not true over Europe. Absolutely not true over there. Churches are closing everywhere and converting themselves into restaurants and stuff like that. Europe is becoming more and more secular. A very important study was done, I think, in 2008, testing the umbilical cord, if there is such an umbilical cord, between the dysfunction of a nation and its religiosity. And believe it or not, America came out to be the most religious nation in the world and also the most dysfunctional. Rebutting the notion, which to me is one of the great deceptions of the last many centuries, that religion has preempted morality. In fact, that religion, in fact, morality needs religion. You hear that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, religion can stand on, I mean, morality can stand on its own two feet, thank you. What we do need, what is true, religion very, very definitely needs morality, no question about that. The evidence is overabundant from the corrupt popes like Borgias throughout the years to the current corrupt evangelical ministers. And more importantly than anything else, we know about the terrible, terrible, horrendous, devastating wars that have been fought throughout the centuries in the name of God and religion, where literally millions of people were slaughtered. So we do know, without any doubt at all, that religion needs morality, but religion has convinced a lot of people that morality needs religion. But what I'm telling you there is something, you could have this conversation with 10,000 other people, but you cannot have the conversation about what's in this book with 10,000 other people, because no one's talking about the fact that Jesus was not born of a virgin. If you know who's talking about it, I don't know who that is, or that the Bible actually says that there's no free will. I'll just give you one citation.
Sure.
In the book, I have 7 or 8. I think it's Isaiah 63:17. Says, "Why, Lord, do you cause us? Do you cause us to stray from thy ways?" Causing us? Where's the free will? Deuteronomy actually says that God consigns all of us to disobedience, so He can show us, mercy. In the 10 plagues of Egypt. It's in Exodus. God is saying that he's going to cause Pharaoh not to release the Israelites from Egypt as a justification for his inflicting these 10 plagues on Egypt. He's going to cause Pharaoh to be stubborn. Some free will. So these things are in the Bible. If people come up to me all the time, do I believe in free will? Do I believe in life and life after death? Stuff like that. I say, why ask me? Ask the local grocer. He knows just as much as I do. However, Jeff, when Christianity says that their positions on these issues is based on the Bible, then I can come aboard and say, wait a while, folks, let's look at the Bible. And the Bible, not only in many instances, does not say what you say it does, but to the contrary, actually refutes what you say. So I'm dealing just with evidence here, not my opinion on this and that, because that's just speculation, and I don't have time for that. And I'm not the brightest guy in the world, but I'm bright enough to know that my opinion on those things is no better than anyone else. But when I look at the evidence, what's in the Bible, then I can weigh in a rather substantive way.
To what extent did you look at the issues of, one, translation of original versions, and also the degree to which there's seemingly contradictory information and interpretation within the Bible?
Not too much. The Dead Sea Scrolls, as you know, and I think it was 1947, they found all these old books of the Bible. The only one they did not find was the book of Esther, but they found a complete book of Isaiah, and it's just absolutely amazing how close those scripts of the old copies of the Bible conform to what we're saying today in modern Bibles. They change a word here and there, but I have found that they don't change the essence.
How do you expect, do you have a sense of how Christianity might react to some of this evidence that you've presented in Divinity of Doubt?
Well, I'd love to hear what, particularly on the virgin birth, I'd love to hear what the Vatican says about it. But my view is that they'd rather stare into the noonday sun than to address themselves to this matter. We're not talking here, Jeff, about two sides to every story. I've never bought that argument. Normally there are two sides to every story, but a lot of times there aren't two sides. There's just one side. I was telling someone a while back when they were saying this, well, Vince, there's two sides to every story. And I said, so you're saying that maybe Hitler had a point. And he said, well, come on. You know, I said, well, you know, there aren't two sides to every story, and there aren't two sides to the story that I'm talking about here. When Isaiah says in chapter 1, verse 22, that Jesus was born of a virgin, and he gives the basis for that, he says it's a fulfillment of a prophecy by Isaiah in the Old Testament, in Isaiah 7:14, when he says that. And then we go to Isaiah 7:14, and there's no reference to a virgin birth. What we see in Isaiah 7:14 is a child, a boy, born to a young woman, not a virgin. The Hebrew word Alma was used. Alma means young woman in Hebrew. There is a word, by the way, for virgin in Hebrew. It's Betula. And if you look at Leviticus and Exodus and Deuteronomy, where the context is talking about a virgin, the word used is Betula. Now, if Isaiah wanted to use the word virgin, if he wanted to talk about a virgin, why in the world would he use a word that does not mean a virgin? That alone shows that there's no scriptural support for Matthew's virgin birth of Jesus. And I might add this, too, that Isaiah, the great prophet, he was prophesying in 7:14, but it had nothing to do with a virgin birth. What it had to do with, he says this young boy, before he reached the age of knowing right from wrong, two kings, the kings of Israel and Syria, and Syria, it was called Aram then, which is ancient Syria, were going to be dead before the time that this boy reached the age of knowing right from wrong. And these two kings, by the way, did die around 730 B.C., which is close to 800 years before Jesus was even born. So there's no question that the prophecy in Isaiah had absolutely nothing with the virgin birth of Jesus. And as I told you further, As I told you further, he doesn't use the word virgin. He uses the word alma, which means young woman, which carries no automatic implication of virginity. If Matthew in 1:22, he also refers to it in 1:18 and 1:23, if he had simply said, and left well enough alone, if he had simply said that Jesus was born of a virgin, the naysayers would say, oh, we don't believe it, and Christianity would say, we do. Neither side could prove the other one wrong, and it would fall into the same category of other alleged miracles, like the parting of the Red Sea, the calming of the storm, walking on water, the resurrection. Neither side could prove the other side wrong. Where Matthew made his absolutely fatal mistake, at least insofar as Christianity is concerned, is he said he was basing this virgin birth on Isaiah 7:14. A prophecy from Isaiah in 7:14, and when we go to Isaiah 7:14, there's no such suggestion of a virgin birth, meaning that we can definitely say, it's not open to interpretation, that if Isaiah falls, then Matthew's virgin birth of Jesus has to fall. This is very heavy stuff, and I think I told you, have I gotten into the fact that that I do have a certain ability to analyze evidence?
Yes. I want to talk a little bit about something else you write about, which is the efficacy or lack thereof with respect to prayer.
Well, if people pray and then they get what they ask for and they say that God answered my prayers, I don't think they really realize what they're saying. Because if they mean what they're saying what? They're saying that God has the power. He has the power to answer prayers. Now, if he has the power to answer prayers, and we know that throughout history, when people desperately needed help, at the very most, he did not help them. Probably the last word on the mouth or on the lips of the 6 million Jews that were killed at Auschwitz was the word God. What about the 25 million people in the world that have died from AIDS? Don't you think these people have prayed to God? And we know that when these people who are praying, need his help the most, he says no. He tells them to take a walk. How can he be a good God when he has the power to stop the Holocaust, to stop all the horrors in the world, and he tells people to take a walk? So when people say God answered my prayers, I don't think they're really thinking of what they're saying. They're really saying that God is bad. I mean, major, big time bad. It doesn't get any worse than your ability to stop horror and atrocity and genocide and not doing anything at all. It doesn't get any worse than that. But no one thinks that. So what they should really realize is that if they get what they pray for, it has nothing to do with God. People have been praying for peace for centuries, trillions of prayers for peace. And yet we still have nations and factions warring very viciously with each other. It never ends. The violence never ends. When are these people ever going to learn that there's no one up there listening to them? Or if he is listening to them, he doesn't have the power to stop the violence. Or if he does have the power to stop the violence, he has no desire to do so. And yet people very fervently continue throughout the world. There supposedly is a sect in the Himalayan mountains, a religious sect, that's been praying 500 years for peace. The Pope prays for peace. And it continues on. When are they ever going to learn that there's no one up there listening to them? But I don't know. Are they thinking that their prayer is going to be the one out of the trillions that's finally going to break the camel's back, and Jesus is going to finally say, okay, I'll give you your peace? Or do they think that maybe it's their prayer? It's their prayer that's going to cause Jesus to give peace? In any event, you have to realize we're not talking about insanity here. We're talking about beyond insanity. And I'd like to approach these people and ask them why in the world they're praying, but I'm being sarcastic, but I'm afraid to go near them. I mean, unbelievable. Millions and trillions of prayers for peace never happens, and they keep praying.
Given that, as we have talked about, that logic, that reason, that evidence is so overwhelming in support of your contention with respect to doubt.
Right.
Is it fair to say that those that don't come to a similar conclusion are operating from essentially an anti-intellectual point of view?
Oh, you're being very, very generous. Yeah, they aren't thinking. Now, mind you, there are great, brilliant minds, people a lot brighter than I am, who believe completely in all this nonsense, you know, Adam and Eve and all that stuff, and the born-again doctrine that if you don't accept Jesus as your Savior, no matter how good a life you lead, you're going to end up in hell. There's all types of brilliant people who believe in that, and I've given some thought to that. How can that be? My view on that, it's the only thing that makes sense to me, is that these inanities and these idiocies are inculcated into them when they're very, very young, very impressionistic, and who's telling them these things? Well, you know, it's in a very formal setting, a priest, a minister, a nun, etc. So they learn it at a very early age, and from that point on, they turn their thinking caps very tightly to the off position, and they continue to reiterate these inanities throughout their lives, even though they're very, very brilliant people. I really wonder, Jeff, if people were exposed for the first time about all this silliness when they were adults, I wonder how many of them would believe as they did. But it's, of course it's anti-intellectual, no question about it.
Vincent Bugliosi, his book, Divinity of Doubt, The God Question, is just out. Vince, as always, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff, for having me on the show. I appreciate it.